Imagine being the second president of a brand new nation. I mean, stepping into the colossal shadow of George Washington, and then after your own tumultuous term preceding another giant, Thomas Jefferson.
Yeah, that's quite the position to be in.
Right, and not just navigating a nation on the brink of war, but then after a lifetime of really immense contributions, dying on the exact same day as your greatest rival and, well, complex friend, the 50th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence itself.
It's almost unbelievable, isn't it? Like something out of fiction.
Exactly. That's just a glimpse into the life of John Adams, a man of unwavering principle, profound contradictions, and often, let's be honest, exasperating stubbornness. Okay, let's unpack this. We've got a treasure trove of information today about a man who often felt destined to be forgotten, yet whose influence indelibly shaped the very foundations of American government.
That fear of being forgotten is such a fascinating part of his psychology, actually.
It really is. From a Boston lawyer defending British soldiers, we'll get into that, to a tenacious diplomat securing vital loans, and then, of course, to the highest office, his story is far richer and more complex than many realize. You might think you know John Adams, but get ready for some truly surprising insights. Our mission today is to go beyond the standard textbook narrative, to truly understand the man behind the myth. We'll uncover why his legacy is both celebrated and, well, for too long, was overlooked.
Yeah, he definitely spent some time in the historical shadows.
You can expect a deep dive into his principled legal battles, shrewd diplomatic triumphs, that tumultuous presidency, and his enduring philosophical impact on American governance.
And what's truly fascinating here is how Adams's personal character, you know, often described as prickly or irascible, was so intrinsically linked to his political actions and deeply held beliefs.
Mm-hmm. Completely intertwined.
We'll see how this tenacity, this willingness to stand firm, even, you know, in the face of widespread opposition, often proved to be America's strength, even if it cost him personal popularity.
Yeah.
Big time.
Oh, it definitely cost him.
We'll also examine the nuanced details of his thought, from his groundbreaking ideas on government structure to his deeply held religious convictions, all of which had a lasting impact on the trajectory of the nation. Mm. His commitment to intellectual rigor and personal integrity, even when unpopular, is just this consistent thread that defines his entire life.
So before he was a revolutionary, before he was a diplomat, before he was president, John Adams was just a kid from Braintree, Massachusetts. Born way back on October 30, 1735.
Right. Humble beginnings in many ways.
Yeah. His father, John Adams Sr., was a deacon, a farmer, a cordwainer, that's a shoemaker, and a militia lieutenant. A man Adams deeply admired and praised throughout his life. His mother, Susanna Boylston, came from a prominent medical family. So this background truly grounds him, doesn't it? He emerged from solid New England stock, steeped in a world of community, hard work, and faith.
Absolutely. And that upbringing provided a foundational framework for his character. Hmm. His formal education began pretty early, age 6, moving from a dame school to Braintree Latin School. The curriculum was quite robust for the era, you know, Latin, rhetoric, logic, arithmetic.
Classics.
Exactly. But young Adams wasn't always the eager scholar. He confessed to truancy and openly disliked his first schoolmaster, even expressing a strong desire to become a farmer instead of continuing his studies.
Imagine history if he'd gotten his wish.
It took his father's firm command to keep him in school and the hiring of a new, more effective schoolmaster, Joseph Marsh, for Adams to respond positively. He later reflected on his mother's profound influence, noting, "As a child, I enjoyed perhaps the greatest of blessings, that of a mother who was anxious and capable to form the characters of her children." So it suggests that even as he struggled with, let's say, academic discipline, his parents instilled in him a strong sense of purpose and the value of education that would later, well, define him.
That youthful desire to just farm to escape the classroom feels so incredibly human, almost relatable. But his father's push and his mother's character-forming influence clearly steered him towards a path less ordinary. He entered Harvard College at 16 in 1751, graduated with his AB in 1755, and an AM in 1758. Now, his father expected him to become a minister, but Adams clearly had other ideas, right?
Oh, definitely.
He spent some time teaching in Worcester, kind of pondering his future.
He certainly did. During those 4 years after graduation, he wasn't just drifting. He was actively seeking honor or reputation and more deference from his fellows, determined, as he put it, to be a great man.
Ambition, plain and simple.
Yes, this ambition, this powerful drive for influence and recognition was a constant force within him. He ultimately decided against the ministry, writing to his father that he found noble and gallant achievements among lawyers in stark contrast to the pretended sanctity of some absolute dunces among the clergy. Pretty harsh words.
Wow, yeah, pulling no punches there.
Though he harbored reservations about his own trumpery and a perceived failure to share the happiness of his fellow men, his path was set. In 1756, he began reading law under James Putnam in Worcester and was admitted to the bar in 1759.
So he finds his calling in law with a clear ambition to make a mark, but it's not just personal ambition that shaped him. He also developed an early habit of diary writing, which offers us incredible insight into his thought process. And one specific event in his early legal career really ignited a spark in him, didn't it?
It did, profoundly so. His impressions of James Otis Jr.'s 1761 challenge to the legality of British writs of assistance were a pivotal moment. These writs were essentially general search warrants, you know, allowing British officials to search homes without specific cause or notice an arbitrary exercise of power that deeply troubled Adams.
You can see why.
Absolutely. Otis's passionate argument against them, delivered in a colonial courtroom, resonated deeply, inspiring Adams to the cause of the American colonies and solidifying his, well, his unwavering legal and moral compass. This commitment to intellectual rigor, his self-directed study of ancient writers like Thucydides, Plato, Cicero, Tacitus, in their original languages combined with this pivotal moment, showcases his early dedication to defending fundamental rights against arbitrary power. It's really the first hint of the principled lawyer and statesman he would become. #1.2, marriage, family, and early political stirrings, 1759 to 1765.
Okay, so away from the courtroom and into the heart, John Adams also experienced the universal human drama of love and family. In the late 1750s, he fell in love with a woman named Hannah Quincy, but apparently a proposal was interrupted and the moment was lost.
Ah, fate.
Right. However, in 1759, he met 15-year-old Abigail Smith, his third cousin, through a friend. His initial impression wasn't exactly glowing, was it? He wrote that she and her sisters were not fond, nor frank, nor candid. Quite a blunt first assessment.
A rather unvarnished assessment indeed. But despite that initial, perhaps superficial reaction, Adams grew very close to Abigail. They shared a profound love of books and developed a relationship built on remarkable honesty, where both praise and criticism were exchanged freely. They were married on October 25, 1764, despite some initial opposition from Abigail's mother.
Interesting. A strong match from the start, it seems.
Definitely.
Yeah.
After his father's death in 1761, Adams inherited a farm and a house in Braintree, where they lived until 1783. This was the stable domestic foundation from which he would embark on his extraordinary public life.
It's compelling to consider the personal side of these historical figures, the love story with Abigail, who became such a pivotal advisor and confidant, but also the challenges of raising a family that included a future president, John Quincy.
A huge weight on any family.
Yeah, they had six children, but their fates were dramatically mixed. While John Quincy, born in 1767, went on to become the sixth president, two of their other sons, Charles and Thomas, sadly succumbed to alcoholism and died at relatively young ages. It reminds us that alongside their grand historical roles, these were real people facing very human struggles and triumphs, providing a poignant backdrop to the unfolding revolution.
Absolutely. This human element is crucial to understanding the founders. And even before the revolutionary fervor fully ignited, Adams was already dabbling in political theory. In 1763, under the pen name Humphrey Plowjogger,
great name,
isn't it? He wrote seven essays for Boston newspapers. In these early writings, he began to articulate his views on power, ridiculing what he called the selfish thirst for power he observed among the Massachusetts colonial elite.
So he's recognizing these power dynamics early on. It's also worth noting that Adams was initially less well-known than his older cousin, Samuel Adams, a real firebrand of popular protest.
Yeah.
How did John's approach differ from his more famous cousin at this stage?
Well, his influence, even then, emerged from his work as a constitutional lawyer, his rigorous analysis of history, and his unwavering dedication to Republican principles. John Adams often found his own irascible nature, as he called it, a constraint in his political career. But this same tenacity would later serve him and the nation in critical moments.
That stubbornness again.
Exactly. The contrast with his cousin Samuel Adams highlights John's preference for legal and constitutional arguments over mob action, a characteristic that would define much of his public life. He sought to address grievances through the rule of law, a foundational principle for him, even then.
This brings us to a pivotal moment where John Adams truly steps onto the national stage. The British Parliament, without consulting colonial American legislatures, passed the Stamp Act in 1765.
Right. Taxation without representation, the classic grievance.
Exactly. This act required the colonies to pay a direct tax for stamp documents, primarily to cover the costs of the Seven Years' War. But it wasn't just the money that angered the colonists. It was the method of implementation. Enforcement power was given to British Vice Admiralty courts, which operated without juries.
That was a huge deal. For colonists, this was a severe blow to fundamental rights, as jury trials were seen as essential protection against arbitrary power.
No doubt. This act was deeply resented, sparking widespread resistance that ultimately prevented its enforcement.
And this context is critical for understanding Adams's emergence as a leader. He rose to prominence by spearheading widespread opposition to the Stamp Act. His key contribution was authoring the Braintree Instructions in 1765, a powerful letter sent to the representatives of Braintree in the Massachusetts legislature.
The Braintree Instructions, right.
This document was a succinct and forthright defense of colonial rights and liberties, arguing that the act denied two fundamental rights guaranteed to all Englishmen, and which all free men deserved: to be taxed only by consent, and to be tried by a jury of one's peers. This document served as a model for other towns, providing a crucial legal blueprint for organized resistance.
This is where Adams truly made his mark, not with a musket, but with a powerful pen. He was all about the principles, the law, even when passions were running high. He even revived his Humphrey Plowjogger pen name for 4 articles in the Boston Gazette that August, further opposing the Stamp Act.
That's a crucial detail. His opposition wasn't just local. It was carefully reasoned and articulated for a broader audience, demonstrating a sophisticated understanding of legal and political theory. These articles were later republished in London, giving his arguments an international platform and intellectual weight.
Wow, taking it to the source.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
He also spoke directly before the governor and council in December, boldly pronouncing the Stamp Act invalid due to the absence of Massachusetts representation in Parliament. He noted that many protests were indeed sparked by a popular sermon from Boston minister Jonathan Mayhew, who invoked Romans 13 to justify insurrection. This period reveals a deep intellectual engagement with both legal precedent and the moral underpinnings of resistance.
So he was actively opposing, speaking out, writing, but he drew a clear line, didn't he? While Adams strongly opposed the act, he explicitly rebuffed attempts by his cousin, Samuel Adams, a leader in more popular protest movements, to involve him in mob actions and public demonstrations.
Right. He wasn't about the violence or the chaos.
He wasn't one for street theatrics or violence, but for constitutional argument. This is a key moment that truly defines his approach to revolution.
Precisely. This is a critical insight into Adams's character. He was a revolutionary, yes, but fundamentally a man of law and order. His opposition to the Stamp Act wasn't just about taxes. It was about the foundational rights of consent and due process, which he saw as being systematically eroded. His methodical, legalistic approach distinguished him from more radical elements and lent intellectual weight and credibility to the colonial cause.
Yeah, give it some real grounding.
And this commitment to legal process would be tested even further, and quite controversially, in the aftermath of the Boston Massacre. In 1766, Braintree elected him as a selectman, demonstrating his growing local influence. #2.2 The Boston Massacre Defense, 1770.
Okay, so with the repeal of the Stamp Act in early 1766, tensions with Britain eased, but short-lived. Britain's passage of the Townshend Acts in 1767 revived those tensions, and an increase in mob violence led the British to dispatch more troops to the colonies.
Things were heating up again.
Definitely. Adams moved his family back to Boston in April 1768 to focus on his law practice, where he quickly became Boston's most prominent lawyer after the death of Jeremiah Gridley and the mental collapse of James Otis Jr. This set the stage for one of the most controversial decisions of his career.
Indeed. On March 5, 1770, a lone British sentry was accosted by a mob. 8 soldiers came to reinforce him, and the crowd swelled to several hundred, pelting the soldiers with snowballs, ice, and stones. In the ensuing chaos, the soldiers opened fire, killing 5 civilians in what became known as the Boston Massacre.
An incredibly charged event.
An explosive situation, deeply inflamed by public sentiment and poised to plunge the city into further chaos. The accused soldiers were arrested on charges of murder.
This is such a striking moment in his life. The man who's building a reputation as a fierce advocate for colonial rights turns around and defends the very British soldiers who fired on his countrymen.
It seems almost counterintuitive, doesn't it?
Totally. When no other attorneys would come to their defense, Adams decided to do so, despite the enormous risk to his own reputation and safety. He profoundly believed that no person, regardless of their actions or public opinion, should be denied the right to counsel and a fair trial. The trials were strategically delayed to allow passions to cool. This reveals a fundamental aspect of his character, his unwavering belief in justice for all, even the most unpopular.
Precisely. It showcases his unwavering belief in the presumption of innocence and the right to counsel, cornerstones of justice, and principles he would later work to enshrine in the Massachusetts Constitution. The week-long trial of Captain Thomas Preston ended in his acquittal, as it was impossible to prove he had ordered his soldiers to fire.
A key point.
Right. The remaining soldiers were tried in December. It was during this trial that Adams delivered his famed argument regarding jury decisions. Facts are stubborn things, and whatever may be our wishes, our inclinations, or the dictates of our passions, they cannot alter the state of facts and evidence. Adams won an acquittal for 6 of the soldiers, with 2 others, who had fired directly into the crowd, convicted of manslaughter.
That commitment to the rule of law, prioritizing facts over passion, is truly powerful. While some historians, like Johnny Ferling, suggest Adams might have strategically influenced jury selection by challenging individual jurors.
There's always that political angle to consider.
True. But Adams's public statements consistently emphasized the supremacy of law and fact over inflamed public sentiment. This act of moral courage, though controversial at the time, solidified his reputation as a principled lawyer who would uphold the law regardless of personal cost, demonstrating a rare and critical independence of mind for a revolutionary leader. Hashtag Chaz 2.3 Growing Disenchantment with Britain, 1772 to 1774. The Boston Massacre trial certainly boosted Adams's law practice and prosperity, but also placed immense demands on his time. In 1774, due to the increasingly unstable situation in Boston, Adams and Abigail returned their family to the farm in Braintree, which remained their permanent Massachusetts home. You can feel a growing unease, can't you?
You absolutely can. Adams, who had initially been among the more conservative of the founding fathers, persistently held that while British actions against the colonies were wrong, open insurrection was unwarranted. He preferred peaceful petition,
yeah.
You know, with the view of remaining part of Great Britain.
Still holding out hope for reconciliation.
For a time. But his ideas began to fundamentally change around 1772. This marks a critical ideological evolution for Adams as he moved from seeking redress for specific grievances to challenging the very nature of Parliament's authority.
And the spark that accelerated this shift was Britain's decision to assume payment of the salaries of Governor Thomas Hutchinson and his judges, bypassing the Massachusetts legislature entirely. Adams, recognizing the grave danger, wrote in the Gazette that these measures would destroy judicial independence and place the colonial government in closer subjugation to the crown.
A direct assault on the separation of powers he so deeply believed in. Precisely. After discontent grew among members of the legislature, Hutchinson delivered a speech warning that Parliament's powers over the colonies were absolute and any resistance illegal. In response, John Adams, along with Samuel Adams and Joseph Hawley, drafted a resolution adopted by the House of Representatives threatening independence as an alternative to tyranny.
Wow, threatening independence already.
This resolution argued a profound point, that the colonists had never been under the sovereignty of Parliament. Their charter, as well as their allegiance, was exclusive to the king. This reinterpretation laid the intellectual groundwork for independence, fundamentally shifting the argument from an appeal to British rights to asserting a distinct American sovereignty.
And then the powder keg ignited. On December 16, 1773, we have the Boston Tea Party, a defiant demonstration against the Tea Act and the British East India Company's tea monopoly. Protesters destroyed 342 chests of tea. While Adams briefly offered legal counsel to the Dartmouth owners, he himself applauded the destruction of the tea, calling it the grandest event in the history of the colonial protest movement.
He really saw it as necessary.
He even wrote in his diary that it was an absolutely and indispensably necessary action. This isn't just a political shift. It's a deeply personal one for him, a recognition that the ties with Britain were fundamentally broken.
It's a clear turning point. His shift from advocating for peaceful petition to endorsing such a defiant act shows his growing conviction that the relationship with Britain was beyond repair through conventional means. This was not a man who embraced radicalism lightly. His endorsement of the Tea Party signifies his realization that constitutional arguments alone were no longer sufficient against what he perceived as escalating tyranny.
The gloves were coming off.
Pretty much. In 1774, in response to the Punitive Intolerable Acts, the First Continental Congress was convened. John Adams, despite an emotional plea from his friend, Attorney General Jonathan Sewall, not to attend, agreed to go as one of the 4 delegates chosen by the Massachusetts legislature. The die was well and truly cast.
So John Adams arrives in Philadelphia for the First Continental Congress, stepping into a room full of delegates with diverse and often conflicting viewpoints. Almost immediately, he was placed on the Grand Committee, tasked with drafting a letter of grievances to King George III. And no surprise, that committee quickly split into conservative and radical factions. Can you imagine the pressure in that room?
Oh, intense. Indeed. And this period is crucial for understanding the nascent American political process. It highlights the deep divisions even among those seeking change from British rule. Adams, as a key figure in the Massachusetts delegation, was vocal. He criticized conservatives like Joseph Galloway and James Duane, who advocated a conciliatory policy or felt the colonies still owed allegiance to Britain.
But he wasn't fully radical yet himself.
Not entirely. His own views at this time still aligned in some ways with those of conservative John Dickinson, as Adams primarily sought the repeal of objectionable policies while still seeing benefits in maintaining ties with Britain. He renewed his push for the fundamental right to a jury trial.
He's advocating for rights, but still hoping for reconciliation. Amidst all this high-stakes diplomacy, he also expressed a very human frustration with the pace and nature of the debates. He complained of what he considered the pretentiousness of the other delegates writing to Abigail. This is great. I believe if it was moved and seconded that we should come to a resolution that 3 and 2 make 5, we should be entertained with logic and rhetoric, law, history, politics, and mathematics concerning the subject for 2 whole days, and then we should pass a resolution unanimously in the affirmative.
Huh. That's classic Adams, isn't it? A detail-oriented lawyer stuck in what felt like endless trivial debates.
Totally.
It perfectly captures his intellectual impatience and his desire for decisive action based on clear principles. Yet, despite his frustrations, Adams ultimately helped engineer a crucial compromise between the conservatives and the radicals. The Congress disbanded in October after sending a petition to the king and, importantly, showing its displeasure with the intolerable acts by endorsing the Suffolk Resolves, which called for a boycott of British goods.
So he could still work across the aisle, so to speak.
This demonstrated an ability to unite disparate factions, even if the process was agonizing for him personally.
And while he was wrestling with these monumental decisions, his personal life was, as always, deeply intertwined. His absence was hard on Abigail, who was left alone to care for their growing family. But her support was unwavering. She still encouraged her husband, sending him powerful letters, she wrote. "You cannot be, I know, nor do I wish to see you an inactive spectator, but if the sword be drawn, I bid adieu to all domestic felicity and look forward to that country where there is neither wars nor rumors of war." What an incredible woman, and what a powerful message of unwavering support and shared conviction.
Her letter underscores the profound personal sacrifices made by the Adams family and so many others during this period. It showcases her strength and her shared conviction in the cause, even as it demanded immense personal cost. This unwavering domestic front allowed Adams to focus his formidable intellect on the task at hand, knowing his family stood with him in spirit, preparing for the inevitable escalation towards independence. #Chag Chag Chag 3.2, Second Continental Congress and Declaration of Independence, 1775 to 1776.
With the news of the opening hostilities at the battles of Lexington and Concord, Adams's hoax for independence soared. He witnessed the militia's high spirits, but also their disorganization. A month later, Adams returned to Philadelphia for the Second Continental Congress, now as a clear leader of the Massachusetts delegation, firmly convinced that Congress was moving towards a full break with Great Britain.
This was Adams at his most influential. He moved cautiously at first, recognizing that Congress was deeply divided between loyalists, those favoring independence, and those hesitant. Publicly, he supported reconciliation if practicable, but privately he aligned with Benjamin Franklin's confidential observation that independence was inevitable.
Playing the long game.
His pragmatism and strategic foresight were becoming increasingly evident.
And in a move that would prove foundational for the American military, in June 1775, with a view to promoting union among the colonies, he nominated George Washington of Virginia as commander-in-chief of the army then assembled around Boston.
A brilliant choice.
He praised Washington's skill and experience, as well as his excellent universal character. A masterstroke, really, unifying the colonies behind a respected Southern leader and cementing a critical military structure.
Absolutely. This was a brilliant political maneuver, crucial for solidifying intercolonial unity. Yet Adams also fiercely opposed various attempts, including the Olive Branch Petition, aimed at finding peace with Britain, invoking the already long list of British actions, he wrote. "In my opinion, powder and artillery are the most efficacious, sure, and infallibly conciliatory measures we can adopt."
Strong words. No more talking.
His frustration with appeasement was palpable. After his failure to prevent the petition from being enacted, he wrote a private letter, derisively, referring to conservative delegate John Dickinson as a piddling genius. The letter was intercepted and published in Loyalist newspapers, leading to a period of ostracization for Adams. As historian Furling notes, by late 1775, quote, no one in Congress labored more ardently than Adams to hasten the day when America would be separate from Great Britain.
That private letter about Dickinson shows us that even founding fathers had their moments of unfiltered frustration. But his intellectual contributions were also profound during this time. He never served as chief judge at the Massachusetts Superior Court. But more importantly, in response to queries from other delegates, Adams wrote the 1776 pamphlet, Thoughts on Government.
Ah, yes. Thoughts on Government. Hugely influential.
This laid out an incredibly influential framework for Republican constitutions, advocating for bicameralism, separation of powers, and enumerated powers for a continental government. This was a blueprint for how a new republic should function.
Indeed. Adams's intellectual contributions here are foundational to American constitutionalism. Throughout the first half of 1776, he grew increasingly impatient with the slow pace of declaring independence. He helped push through a plan to outfit armed ships to launch raids on enemy vessels and later drafted the first set of regulations for the Provisional Navy, a true one-man war department in many respects.
Getting things done.
He also drafted the preamble to the Lee Resolution. It's during this time he developed a rapport with Thomas Jefferson, who had been slower to support independence, but by early 1776 agreed it was necessary.
Then, on June 7, 1776, the moment arrived. Adams seconded the Lee Resolution, which declared that the colonies were free and independent states. This was the true breaking point.
It was. Prior to independence being declared, Adams organized a committee of five, charged with drafting a Declaration of Independence, selecting himself, Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, Robert R. Livingston, and Roger Sherman. Though Jefferson thought Adams should write the document, Adams persuaded the committee to choose Jefferson.
Why was that?
He later recorded his reasoning to Jefferson. Reason first, you are a Virginian, and a Virginian ought to appear at the head of this business. Reason second, I am obnoxious, suspected, and unpopular. You are very much otherwise. Reason third, you can write 10 times better than I can.
What a humble yet shrewd assessment of his own political standing and Jefferson's writing prowess. While Jefferson wrote the first draft, Adams assumed a major role in the process. On July 1st, the resolution was debated in Congress, with opponents like Dickinson making a strong effort to resist it. Jefferson, a famously poor debater, remained silent while Adams argued fiercely for its adoption.
He really carried the weight of that debate. Many years later, Jefferson hailed Adams as the pillar of the Declaration's support on the floor of Congress, its ablest advocate and defender against the multifarious assaults it encountered.
High praise from a rival.
This is a critical testament to Adams' persuasive power and intellectual force. On July 2, Congress officially voted for independence, with 12 colonies voting affirmatively and New York abstaining. Dickinson was notably absent. On July 3, Adams wrote to Abigail that yesterday was decided the greatest question which was ever debated in America. He famously predicted that the second day of July, 1776, will be the most memorable epoch in the history of America and will be celebrated annually.
He got the date slightly wrong, but the sentiment was right.
Huh? Yes, just missed it by a couple of days. Congress formally approved the Declaration of Independence on July 4. His vision for governance was being laid out in real time, with immense personal and political effort, fundamentally redefining the American experiment. Hashtag 3.3 war effort and peace efforts, 1776 to 1777.
This period is Adams at his most influential, truly an engine of the revolution. His workload was immense. Benjamin Rush reported he was acknowledged to be the first man in the House. He sat on 90 committees, chaired 25.
An unmatched workload. It's staggering, really.
In June 1776, he became head of the Board of War and Ordnance, a de facto secretary of war. He was referred to as a one-man war department, working up to 18-hour days, mastering the details of raising, equipping, and fielding an army under civilian control.
This demonstrates Adams's extraordinary capacity for work and his deep understanding of logistics and strategy. The depth of his involvement in the Board of War reveals a crucial, often overlooked insight. For Adams, the American Revolution wasn't just a fight of ideals, but a grueling exercise in practical administration.
Right, the unglamorous stuff.
Exactly. He understood that without the unglamorous work of supplies and discipline, grand declarations meant nothing. He was worn out by the rigor of his duties and longed to return home, but the crisis caused by the defeat of American soldiers kept him at his post, a testament to his selflessness.
And then came a brief but incredibly telling attempt at peace. After defeating the Continental Army at the Battle of Long Island in August 1776, British Admiral Richard Howe requested Congress send representatives to negotiate. A delegation consisting of Adams, Franklin, and Edward Rutledge met with Howe at the Staten Island Peace Conference. But there was no common ground, was there? Howe's authority was premised on the state's submission to the crown.
Exactly. When Lord Howe stated he could view the American delegates only as British subjects, Adams famously replied, "Your lordship may consider me in what light you please, except that of a British subject."
Boom. That's the spirit.
This defiant spirit, this absolute refusal to concede even a rhetorical inch of American sovereignty, was Adams encapsulated in a single sentence. He was unimpressed with Howe and confidently predicted American success. He learned many years later that his name was on a list of people specifically excluded from Howe's pardon-granting authority, underscoring the British recognition of his pivotal role.
After a brief respite at home, Adams returned to Congress, but the brutal realities of war had shifted his focus. It was no longer enough to just declare independence. The nation needed to secure its survival through strategic alliances. What was his next move?
He immediately refocused on strategy, advocating in Congress that independence was necessary to establish trade, and conversely, that trade was essential for the attainment of independence. He specifically urged the negotiation of a commercial treaty with France.
Diplomacy and trade, hand in hand.
Right. He was appointed, along with Franklin and others, to prepare a plan of treaties to be proposed to foreign powers. While Jefferson was writing the Declaration, Adams worked on the Model Treaty, which authorized a commercial agreement with France, but contained no provisions for formal recognition or military assistance. The treaty adhered to the provision that free ships make free goods, meaning a neutral country could trade with a warring nation and their non-military goods wouldn't be seized.
A pragmatic approach initially?
Yes, but by late 1777, America's finances were in tatters and a British army had captured Philadelphia. More Americans came to determine that mere commercial ties would not be enough. Military assistance would be needed. The American victory at Saratoga was expected to help induce France to agree to a full alliance, and Adams, ever pragmatic, was ready to adapt his strategy.
Adams's tireless work in the Continental Congress soon led him to a new, vital role, diplomat. In November 1777, he learned that he was to be named commissioner to France, joining Benjamin Franklin and Arthur Lee in Paris to negotiate an alliance.
A huge responsibility. James Lovell invoked Adams's inflexible integrity and the need for a youthful man to counterbalance Franklin's age. On November 27, Adams accepted, a decision that would lead to one of the most perilous journeys of his life.
It was indeed a monumental undertaking. Abigail was left in Massachusetts to manage their home, but it was agreed that their 10-year-old son, John Quincy, would accompany Adams, as the experience was deemed of inestimable value to his maturation.
Imagine sending your 10-year-old on that voyage.
Incredible. On February 17, 1778, Adams set sail aboard the frigate Boston. The trip was stormy and treacherous. British vessels pursued the ship, with Adams personally taking up arms to help capture one. Tragically, a cannon malfunction wounded several sailors and killed one. On April 1st, the Boston arrived in France, where Adams learned that France had already agreed to an alliance with the United States on February 6, before he'd even arrived.
Talk about arriving after the party started.
Adams and Franklin together in Paris. You'd think that would be a dream team. But it sounds like a classic odd couple scenario, with Adams's pragmatism clashing with Franklin's more laid-back diplomacy. Adams was clearly annoyed by the other two commissioners. Lee, whom he thought paranoid and cynical, and the popular and influential Franklin, whom he found lethargic and overly deferential to the French.
Different styles, for sure. Adams assumed a less visible role, but meticulously helped manage the delegation's finances and record-keeping, clearly ready to roll up his sleeves and demand action, even taking up arms on the journey over.
He wasn't just going to sit back.
This period reveals Adams's relentless drive and his deep-seated distrust of relying solely on the goodwill of allies. Frustrated by the perceived lack of commitment on the part of the French, Adams wrote a letter to French Foreign Minister Vergennes in December, arguing for more robust French naval support in North America. Franklin, ever the smoother diplomat, toned down the letter, but Vergennes ultimately ignored it, further fueling Adams's exasperation.
You can just picture Adams fuming.
Oh, undoubtedly. In September 1778, Congress increased Franklin's powers by naming him Minister Plenipotentiary to France while Lee was sent to Spain. Adams received no instructions, signaling his reduced role. Feeling slighted and his presence unneeded, he departed France with John Quincy on March 8, 1779, arriving back in Braintree on August 2. His determination to see his son gain experience abroad, even in perilous circumstances, reflects his belief in rigorous education for future leaders. #4.2 Ambassador to the Dutch Republic, 1780 to 1782.
Despite the frustrations in France, Adams's diplomatic skills were far from finished. In late 1779, he was appointed as the sole minister charged with negotiations to establish a commercial treaty with Britain and ultimately to end the war. Following the Massachusetts Constitutional Convention, he departed for France in November, again accompanied by his sons John Quincy and a now 9-year-old Charles, after another arduous journey involving a ship leak and an overland trek across Spain.
Another immense personal sacrifice for Adams and his family. While in France, constant disagreement between Lee and Franklin eventually resulted in Adams assuming the role of tiebreaker in almost all votes on commission business. He pragmatically increased his usefulness by mastering French, and Lee was eventually recalled.
Smart move, learning the language.
Absolutely. Adams also closely supervised his son's education, while writing to Abigail about once every 10 days, a testament to his dedication to family, even amidst national crisis.
In contrast to Franklin, Adams viewed the Franco-American alliance with a healthy dose of pessimism. He believed the French were primarily involved for their own self-interest, and he grew increasingly frustrated by what he saw as their sluggishness in providing substantial aid. He famously wrote that the French meant to keep their hands above our chin to prevent us from drowning, but not to lift our heads out of water.
It perfectly captures his shrewd assessment of international relations. His direct, unvarnished approach, while sometimes creating friction, often cut through diplomatic niceties to address fundamental issues. In March 1780, Congress, attempting to curb inflation, voted to devalue the dollar. Vergennes summoned Adams, insisting this fluctuation was unacceptable without an exception for French merchants. Adams bluntly defended the decision, not only claiming French merchants were doing better than Vergennes implied, but voicing grievances about the alliance, arguing France needed to commit more fully.
He wasn't backing down.
Not at all. Vergennes, angered, stated he would deal only with Franklin, who then sent a letter to Congress critical of Adams. Adams, feeling unsupported and unheard, left France of his own accord.
So he takes his talents elsewhere, literally. In mid-1780, Adams traveled to the Dutch Republic, one of the few other republics at the time. He thought it might be sympathetic to the American cause, and crucially, securing a Dutch loan could increase American independence from France and pressure Britain into peace.
A strategic pivot. At first, he had no official status, but in July, he was formally given permission to negotiate for a loan and took up residence in Amsterdam in August.
Did it go smoothly there?
Not initially. His optimism was high, but he soon became disappointed. The Dutch, fearing British retaliation, especially after the British discovered secret aid they had sent to the Americans, refused to meet with Adams. Word of American battlefield defeats also reached Europe, further dampening their enthusiasm. After 5 months without meeting a single Dutch official, Adams, in early 1781, pronounced Amsterdam the capital of the reign of Mammon.
Ouch, his frustration was boiling over.
Understandably. In July, he consented to the departure of both his sons. John Quincy went to St. Petersburg as a French interpreter to seek recognition from Russia, and a homesick Charles returned home.
This was a period of incredible highs and lows for Adams. In August, shortly after being removed from his position as sole head of peace treaty negotiations, Adams suffered a major nervous breakdown. This was a true testament to the immense pressure and isolation he felt.
It truly encapsulates his personal sacrifices and resilience. However, that November, he learned that American and French troops had decisively defeated the British at Yorktown. The victory was, in large part, due to the assistance of the French Navy, which, in a vindicating moment, proved Adams's earlier stance for increased naval assistance correct.
Vindication must have felt good.
The news of the American triumph at Yorktown convulsed Europe, creating a new diplomatic opening.
In January 1782, after recovering, Adams arrived at The Hague to demand that the States General answer his petitions. When his efforts stalled, he took his cause directly to the people, successfully capitalizing on popular pro-American sentiment. Several provinces began recognizing American independence. On April 19th, the States General formally recognized American independence and acknowledged Adams as ambassador.
This was a monumental diplomatic victory, achieved through sheer persistence and a direct appeal to the people. A clear departure from traditional European diplomacy. On June 11th, with the aid of the Dutch patriot and leader Joan van der Capellen-Tocht-en-Pol, Adams negotiated a loan of 5 million guilders. In October, he negotiated a treaty of amity and commerce. The house that Adams bought during his stay in the Netherlands became the first American embassy on foreign soil, a powerful symbol of American sovereignty. Securing that loan was not just financial. It was a strategic move to assert American independence from all European powers, including France, and critical for national solvency. #4.3 Treaty of Paris, 1782-1783.
Fresh off his triumph in the Dutch Republic, Adams was immediately reappointed as the American commissioner to negotiate the war-ending treaty, the Treaty of Paris. French foreign minister Vergin and France's minister to the United States disapproved of Adams, so Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, John Jay, and Henry Lawrence were appointed to collaborate with him, although only Franklin and Jay were consistently present.
So he was back on a team, but with some significant internal and external resistance. The stage was set for complex negotiations. In the final negotiations, securing fishing rights off Newfoundland and Cape Breton Island proved both very important and very difficult.
These weren't minor details, right? Vital for New England?
Absolutely. Vital for the economy and a symbol of national sovereignty. In response to very strict restrictions proposed by the British, Adams insisted that not only should American fishermen be allowed to travel as close to shore as desired, but that they should also be allowed to cure their fish on the shores of Newfoundland. His tenacity on this point was characteristic.
And this insistence, along with other strong statements, prompted Vergin to secretly inform the British that France did not feel compelled to sustain these pretentious ambitions of the Americans. This highlights a crucial dynamic. The French were allies, but also had their own interests.
Definitely. Overruling Franklin and deeply distrustful of Vergin's motivations, Jay and Adams made a bold move. They decided not to consult with France, instead dealing directly with the British.
Going rogue. A masterclass in independent diplomacy.
This was a pivotal, controversial, but ultimately brilliant strategic decision. During these independent negotiations, Adams leveraged the French position against itself. He mentioned to the British that his proposed fishing terms were more generous than those offered by France in 1778, arguing that accepting them would foster goodwill between Britain and the United States while simultaneously putting pressure on France.
Clever, playing them off each other.
Britain agreed to Adams' terms, and the two sides worked out other provisions afterward. Vergin was angered when he learned from Franklin of the American duplicity, but he didn't demand renegotiation. He was surprised at how much the Americans could extract. This willingness to go rogue reveals Adams' deep conviction that America's interests, even when unpopular with allies, must always come first, a principle crucial for establishing the new nation's true sovereignty.
So, his willingness to challenge conventional diplomacy and act on principle, even if controversial, yielded significant benefits for the nascent nation. On September 3, 1783, the Treaty of Paris was signed, and American independence was formally recognized. This was a triumph not just for America, but for Adams's tenacious, independent diplomatic style. #4.4 Ambassador to Great Britain, 1785-1788. Fresh from helping negotiate the peace treaty, Adams was then appointed as the very first American ambassador to Great Britain in 1785. Can you imagine the sheer symbolism of that? The former rebel, now representing his sovereign nation to the very monarch he defied.
It was an extraordinary moment in history, and Adams meticulously recorded his first audience with King George III on June 1, 1785. The exchange was remarkably respectful. Adams promised to do all he could to restore friendship and cordiality between people who, though separated sick by an ocean and under different governments, had the same language, a similar religion, and kindred blood.
Trying to build bridges.
The king, for his part, agreed to receive with pleasure the assurances of the friendly dispositions of the United States.
But then, the king threw a curveball, didn't he? He startled Adams by commenting that there is an opinion among some people that you are not the most attached of all your countrymen to the manners of France. Adams famously replied, "That opinion, sir, is not mistaken. I have no attachments but to my own country."
Perfect Adams response.
And King George, perhaps surprisingly, responded, "An honest man will never have any other." This exchange, steeped in mutual respect despite their history, truly highlights Adams' consistent Republican principles even when abroad. His honesty and unwavering patriotism cut through the formal diplomatic setting.
Indeed. Adams was joined by Abigail in London, but they often suffered the hostility of the king's courtiers. They found solace by seeking out Richard Price, a minister who advocated for the American Revolution within Britain. Adams also corresponded diligently with his sons at Harvard, emphasizing the importance of intellectual development.
He never stopped being a father, even as ambassador.
His old friend Jonathan Sewell, now a loyalist exile, visited Adams in London, but they discovered their paths had diverged too much to renew their friendship, a poignant casualty of the war. Sewell offered a pointed critique of Adams as an ambassador, stating he lacked the courtly graces to dance, drink, game, flatter, small talk, and flirt with the ladies.
That perfectly captures the contrast between Adams's blunt, principled nature and the superficial demands of courtly life. While in London, Adams also wrote his three-volume MOP, A Defense of the Constitutions of Government of the United States of America, a direct response to European critics of American state government frameworks.
This wasn't just a rebuttal. It was a profound articulation of his political philosophy, emphasizing the need for robust governmental structures and a mixed government that balanced different social forces. His consistent vision for a stable, virtuous republic founded on laws, not men, shines through in this work.
But his job wasn't easy.
No. Adams's tenure in Britain was complicated by both countries failing to follow their treaty obligations. The American states were delinquent in paying debts owed to British merchants, and in response, the British refused to vacate forts in the Northwest as promised. Adams's attempts to resolve this dispute failed, and he was often frustrated by a lack of progress from home. The fragility of the new nation and the domestic instability, such as Shays' Rebellion, further complicated his efforts to establish America's credibility on the global stage. He eventually asked to be relieved, and in 1788, took his leave of George III. He then went to The Hague to secure refinancing from the Dutch, allowing the United States to meet obligations on earlier loans, solidifying his reputation as a master financial diplomat.
After years of intense, sometimes life-threatening diplomatic service abroad, Adams returned to Massachusetts in June 1788 to a triumphant welcome. He initially returned to farming life, but the nation's first presidential election was rapidly approaching. With George Washington widely expected to win the presidency unanimously, there was a strong feeling that the vice presidency should go to a northerner, and Adams was the primary contender.
This inaugural election reveals the early fault lines in American politics, even before formal parties fully developed. Each state's presidential electors gathered on February 4, 1789 to cast their two votes. Adams received 34 Electoral College votes, placing him second behind Washington, who was, as expected, a unanimous choice with 69 votes.
Adams finished well ahead of all others except Washington, but he was profoundly offended by Washington receiving more than twice as many votes. Imagine being the second in command and finding out your election was partly a strategic manipulation to ensure you didn't accidentally become president.
Yeah, that had to sting.
Alexander Hamilton, in an effort to prevent Adams from potentially tying Washington and to ensure Washington's overwhelming victory, convinced at least 7 of the 69 electors not to cast their vote for Adams. The audacity. After finding out about the manipulation, though not Hamilton's direct role in it at the time, Adams wrote to Benjamin Rush that his election was a curse rather than a blessing. This deeply personal reaction profoundly shaped Adams's perception of his office and his subsequent frustrations.
It's a key example of how personal relationships and political machinations, even among the founders, impacted the formation of the government and the nascent role of the vice presidency. Although his term officially started on March 4, 1789, Adams did not begin serving as vice president until April 25, due to his late arrival in New York. This late start perhaps further contributed to his sense of being somewhat sidelined from the outset. #5.2, his rotundity and Senate controversy, 1789.
Now, let's talk about the vice president's role. The sole constitutionally prescribed responsibility of the vice president is to preside over the U.S. Senate, where they were empowered to cast a tie-breaking vote. But early in his term, Adams became deeply involved in a rather lengthy Senate controversy over official titles for the president and executive officers of the new government.
The titles debate. A classic moment.
While the House agreed on George Washington, president of the United States, the Senate debated the issue at length. And Adams had some strong opinions, didn't he?
He certainly did. Adams favored the style of highness and even the title of protector of the United States liberties for the president. Some senators favored similar elevated titles. However, anti-federalists in the Senate vehemently objected to the monarchical sound of these titles. Thomas Jefferson, with his characteristic wit, described them as superlatively ridiculous.
Jefferson really had a way with words.
They argued that these distinctions, as Adams called them, directly violated the Constitution's prohibition on titles of nobility, reflecting a deep-seated American fear of anything resembling European aristocracy.
John Adams, the staunch Republican, advocating for His Highness, and then being nicknamed His Rotundity. It's almost comical, but it speaks volumes about the early Republic's anxieties about monarchical power and Adams's inability to read the room sometimes.
He argued that such distinctions were necessary because the highest office of the United States must be marked with dignity and splendor to command respect on the world stage.
He was widely derided for his combative nature and stubbornness, especially as he actively debated and lectured the senators.
Not winning many friends there.
This episode, while seemingly trivial in retrospect, underscores a fundamental tension in early American identity, balancing the need for governmental dignity with a fervent rejection of European aristocratic traditions. Senator William McClay of Pennsylvania, Adams' fiercest opponent, recorded that Adams, "For 40 minutes he harangued us from the chair and privately likened him to a monkey just put into breeches."
Ouch.
It was Ralph Izard who suggested Adams be referred to as his rotundity, a joke that quickly became popular. On May 14, 1789, the Senate decided that the simple title of Mr. President would be used. Privately, Adams conceded that his vice presidency had begun poorly and that perhaps he had been out of the country too long to accurately gauge the sentiment of the people. This highlights the challenging and often thankless nature of the vice presidency, especially in its infancy. #5.3 Federalist Alignment and Frustration, 1789-1797.
Despite that rocky start as vice president, Adams largely sided with the Washington administration and the emerging Federalist Party. He supported Washington's policies against opposition from the anti-Federalist Republicans. He wasn't just a silent figurehead either. He cast 29 tie-breaking votes, which is quite significant.
Really shaping key early decisions. He notably voted against a bill sponsored by his nemesis, McClay, that would have required Senate consent for the removal of executive branch officials.
And he played a role in the Capitol location debate too, right?
His active use of the tie-breaking vote demonstrates his commitment to the Federalist agenda. In 1790, for example, when Jefferson, James Madison, and Hamilton struck a bargain to move the Capitol to the Potomac River, Adams cast a tie-breaking vote against a last-minute motion to keep the Capitol in New York. These were crucial early decisions.
But despite his active participation, Adams often felt deeply frustrated by the limitations of his office. He played a minor role in politics as vice president, attending few cabinet meetings, and President Washington sought his counsel infrequently. While Adams brought energy and dedication by mid-1789, he already found the office not quite adapted to my character, too inactive and mechanical.
And then came that famous quote.
Exactly. He famously wrote, "My country has in its wisdom contrived for me the most insignificant office that ever the invention of man contrived or his imagination conceived." That's a profound statement of feeling underutilized.
This period shows Adams's practical political alignment with the Federalists, but also his internal struggle with the limitations of his office. His initial behavior in the Senate made him a target for critics, but toward the end of his first term, he grew accustomed to a more marginal role. He never questioned Washington's courage or patriotism, but he did view Washington and Franklin as often overshadowing his own contributions.
That quote about the electrical rod?
Oh, yes. He once declared, "The history of our revolution will be one continued lie. The essence of the whole will be that Dr. Franklin's electrical rod smote the earth and outsprung General Washington, that Franklin electrified him with his rod, and henceforth these two conducted all the policy, negotiations, legislatures, and war."
Wow. Pretty spicy, revealing his deep-seated feelings of being overshadowed, even while serving faithfully. Despite these frustrations, Adams won re-election with little difficulty in 1792.
His electoral success, despite his personal frustrations, indicates his political standing. On the international stage, the French Revolution began. Republicans were jubilant. Adams at first expressed cautious optimism, but soon began denouncing the revolutionaries as barbarous and tyrannical. His profound observations on the French Revolution foreshadowed the intense partisan divisions it would cause in America.
A real dividing line.
Washington eventually consulted Adams more often, but not until near the end of his administration. When John Jay returned in 1795 with a peace treaty on terms unfavorable to the United States, mainly concerning British raiding American trading vessels, Adams urged Washington to sign it to prevent war. Washington did so, igniting protests and riots across the nation.
His support for the Jay Treaty, despite its widespread unpopularity, highlights his consistent priority of avoiding war and maintaining national stability, even at significant personal political cost, a theme that would define his presidency. Adams accurately predicted in a letter to Abigail that ratification would deeply divide the nation, demonstrating his foresight. Okay, so we arrive at the presidency. The 1796 election was a monumental one, the first truly contested American presidential election. George Washington had been elected unanimously twice, but deep philosophical differences between Hamilton and Jefferson had caused a serious rift, leading to the founding of the Federalist and Republican parties.
A whole new era of politics kicking off. When Washington announced he would not stand for a third term, an intense partisan struggle for control of Congress and the presidency began.
It was a whole new ballgame for American politics. No candidates were formally put forward. The Constitution, as it stood, provided for the selection of electors. Jefferson was the clear Republican favorite, with Aaron Burr nominated as his running mate. Adams was the Federalist frontrunner, with Thomas Pinckney nominated alongside him.
The campaign itself was brutal, characterized by malicious insults from partisan presses on both sides, pamphlets, and political rallies. Adams, ever the principled man, stated he wanted to stay out of the silly and wicked game of electioneering.
But his own party was proving to be his biggest challenge. As the campaign progressed, fears grew among Alexander Hamilton and his supporters that Adams was too vain, opinionated, unpredictable, and stubborn to follow their directions.
Hamilton wanted someone more pliable. Adams indeed did not consider himself a strong Federalist, having remarked that Hamilton's economic program, centered around banks, would swindle the poor and unleash the gangrene of avarice.
Strong feelings there. So Hamilton maneuvered to tip the election to Pinckney, coercing South Carolina Federalist electors to scatter their second votes among candidates other than Adams. The audacity. Hamilton actively trying to undermine Adams.
It truly highlights the venomous nature of early partisan politics. Hamilton's scheme, however, was undone when several New England state electors heard of it and agreed not to vote for Pinckney, which inadvertently ensured Adams's victory.
So Hamilton's plan backfired.
Pretty much. Adams won the presidency by a narrow margin, receiving 71 electoral votes to 68 for Jefferson, who, as the second highest vote getter, became the vice president. This remains the only election in U.S. history where a president and vice president were elected from opposing tickets, a unique outcome that profoundly shaped Adams's term.
Talk about an awkward situation from day one.
Adams was sworn into office as the nation's second president on March 4, 1797. He conscientiously followed Washington's lead in using the presidency to exemplify Republican values and civic virtue, and his service was thankfully free of scandal. Hashtag tag 6.2, early presidency and cabinet challenges, 1797.
So Adams walks into the presidency, and his own cabinet is essentially loyal to his arch rival, Hamilton. That's a political minefield right there. He spent much of his term at his Massachusetts home, Peacefield, preferring the quietness of domestic life to business at the Capitol. He also largely ignored the political patronage and office seeking, which other office holders utilized.
Yeah, historians debate the wisdom of that. Indeed, his decision to retain Washington's cabinet, given its deep loyalty to Hamilton, proved to be a significant vulnerability. Jefferson famously remarked that the Hamiltonians who surround him are only a little less hostile to him than to me.
Wow. Your own cabinet against you.
While Adams's rationale was that retaining the cabinet would ensure a smoother succession, believing in institutional stability, it created an internal opposition within his own administration, making independent governance exceptionally difficult. Adams was aware of Hamilton's influence, but perhaps misjudged its depth.
That's a very noble, if perhaps naive, belief given the political climate. Even with that, Adams maintained the economic programs of Hamilton, who regularly consulted with key cabinet members, especially the powerful Treasury Secretary, Oliver Wolcott Jr. But in other respects, Adams was quite independent of his cabinet, often making decisions despite opposition from it.
He clearly wasn't going to be a puppet. Hamilton had grown accustomed to being regularly consulted by Washington. Shortly after Adams was inaugurated, Hamilton sent him a detailed letter with policy suggestions. Adams, clearly asserting his independence, dismissively ignored it.
A clear signal, I'm in charge now.
This speaks to Adams's belief in institutional stability, but also perhaps to a misjudgment of the depth of Hamilton's influence over these individuals. This lack of a loyal inner circle would continually complicate his efforts and contribute to the challenges he faced throughout his presidency. The scene was set for a presidency defined by internal struggle and foreign policy crises. Hashtag attach tag 6.3 foreign policy and the XYZ affair, 1797 to 1798.
Historian Joseph Ellis writes that the Adams presidency was destined to be dominated by a single question, whether to make war with France or find peace. This was an incredibly tense time. Britain and France were locked in a war stemming from the French Revolution. Hamilton and the Federalists strongly favored the British monarchy. Jefferson and the Republicans strongly supported the French overthrowing their king.
A deeply divided nation on foreign policy. It was a tightrope walk for Adams. The French, having supported Jefferson for president in 1796, became belligerent at his loss. Adams continued Washington's policy of staying out of the war, a policy of American neutrality. However, because of the Jay Treaty, the French saw America as Britain's junior partner and began seizing American merchant ships that were trading with the British.
So America was caught in the middle.
Exactly. Most Americans were still pro-French due to France's assistance during the Revolution and their desire to support a republic against the British monarchy and would not tolerate war with France.
So he's caught between a rock and a hard place. On May 16, 1797, Adams gave a speech to Congress in which he called for increasing defense capabilities in case of war with France. He announced that he would send a peace commission to France, but simultaneously called for a military buildup.
A two-pronged approach. The speech was well received by the Federalists, but the Republicans were outraged, seeing it as a failure to support the French Republic and a call for war. His commitment to neutrality, even against strong partisan pressures, was often misunderstood by both sides.
And the peace commission he appointed consisted of John Marshall, Charles Cotesworth Pinckney, and Elbridge Gerry. But there was drama behind the scenes too, right?
Oh, yes. Adding to the internal drama, Jefferson, Adams's own vice president, was secretly undermining him. He met four times with Joseph Latoum, the French consul in Philadelphia, suggesting that it was in France's best interest to treat the American ministers civilly, but then drag out the negotiations at length. According to Latoum, Jefferson even called Adams vain, suspicious, and stubborn.
Unbelievable. The VP working against the president. This brings us to the infamous XYZ affair. When the envoys arrived in October, they were kept waiting for several days and then granted only a 15-minute meeting with French Foreign Minister Talleyrand.
A deliberate snub.
The diplomats were then met by three of Talleyrand's agents, later codenamed X, Y, and Z, who refused to conduct negotiations unless the United States paid enormous bribes to France and to Talleyrand personally. Supposedly, this was to make up for offenses given to France by Adams in his speech. The Americans, understandably, refused. Marshall and Pinckney returned home, while Gerry remained. American diplomats being told they had to pay a bribe just to talk, that's outrageous.
It was a blatant insult to American sovereignty. News of the disastrous peace mission arrived in March 1798. Adams, not wanting to incite violence, announced the mission had failed without providing details. He also asked Congress for a renewal of the nation's defenses. The Republicans, suspecting he might be hiding material favorable to France, voted overwhelmingly to demand that Adams release the papers.
And when he did.
Once they were released, the Republicans, according to Abigail, were struck dumb. Benjamin Franklin Bosch, editor of the Philadelphia Aurora, tried to blame Adams's aggression, but among the general public, the affair substantially weakened popular American support of France. Adams reached the height of his popularity as many in the country called for a full-scale war against the French.
It completely shifts public opinion, putting Adams at the peak of his popularity. This was a defining crisis for the Adams presidency. It dramatically exposed French perfidy and unified American public opinion behind Adams, momentarily silencing his Republican critics. It underscored the aggressive nature of European powers and the young nation's vulnerability. #6.4 Alien and Sedition Acts, 1798. Despite the XYZ affair galvanizing public opinion against France and boosting Adams' popularity, Republican opposition persisted at home. Federalists began accusing the French and their immigrant sympathizers of provoking civil unrest. In an attempt to quell this outcry, the Federalists introduced, and Congress passed, a series of laws collectively referred to as the Alien and Sedition Acts.
And this is where things get really controversial. These acts are almost universally condemned by historians and are often seen as a significant stain on Adams's legacy.
Four acts passed in quick succession. The Naturalization Act, the Alien Friends Act, the Alien Enemies Act, and the Sedition Act. Jefferson called it an unguarded passion.
The first three acts targeted immigrants, giving the president greater deportation authority and increasing citizenship requirements. The Sedition Act, however, was the most contentious, making it a crime to publish false, scandalous, and malicious writing against the government or its officials. This was a direct challenge to the principles of free speech.
A direct challenge to the First Amendment, indeed. And Adams signed them into law in June 1798 at the urging of his wife and cabinet, though he had not personally promoted any of these acts.
While born out of genuine fears of French influence and internal subversion during a quasi-war, their scope and enforcement were problematic. The administration initiated numerous indictments under the Sedition Act, targeting prominent Republican newspapers. Vocal opponents of the Federalists were imprisoned or fined for criticizing the government, including Congressman Matthew Lyon of Vermont.
So they were actively used to suppress dissent.
Yes, though the Alien Acts were not stringently enforced because Adams resisted Secretary of State Timothy Pickering's attempts to deport aliens, although many left on their own due to the hostile environment.
Republicans were predictably outraged. Jefferson, disgusted by the acts, wrote nothing publicly but partnered with James Madison to secretly draft the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions. Jefferson, writing for Kentucky, argued that states had the natural right to nullify any acts they deemed unconstitutional.
This highlights the profound tension between national security and individual liberties, a debate that continues to resonate today, and it certainly fueled the political fire against Adams. Federalists reacted bitterly to the resolutions, and the acts ultimately energized and unified the Republican Party while doing little to unite the Federalists. It provided potent ammunition for the upcoming election. #, #, 6.5, the Quasi-War and Military Buildup, 1798-1800.
In May 1798, a French privateer captured a merchant vessel off of New York Harbor, marking an increase in attacks on sea and the beginning of the undeclared naval war known as the Quasi-War. Adams was now directly confronted with the threat of conflict.
His strategy was astute, knowing that America would be unable to win a major conflict due to internal divisions and France's dominance in Europe. He pursued a strategy of harassing French ships in an effort sufficient to stem the French assaults on American interests, a limited strategic warfare approach.
Trying to avoid a full-scale disaster.
This reveals Adams's profound commitment to peace, even when it meant alienating powerful figures within his own party. In May, shortly after the attack in New York, Congress created a separate Navy department. Adams then built up the Navy, adding 6 fast, powerful frigates, most notably the USS Constitution. This leadership on naval defense sometimes led him to be called the father of the American Navy, a title he truly earned.
He literally earned the title father of the American Navy here, but it came with immense personal and political cost. The prospect of a French invasion also led to calls to build up the army. Hamilton and other high Federalists were particularly adamant that a large army be called up, despite a common fear, particularly among Republicans, that large standing armies were subversive to liberty.
A classic tension. In May, a provisional army of 10,000 soldiers was authorized by Congress. And in July, Congress created 12 infantry regiments and provided for 6 cavalry companies, exceeding Adams's requests but falling short of Hamilton's more ambitious plans.
And then the fight over who would lead it.
The internal struggle over military appointments highlights the profound ideological chasm developing within the Federalist Party. Federalists pressured Adams to appoint Hamilton. Distrustful of Hamilton and fearing a plot to subvert his administration, Adams chose Washington instead, without consulting him. As a condition of his acceptance, Washington demanded he be permitted to appoint his own subordinates, wishing to have Henry Knox as second in command, followed by Hamilton and then Charles Pinckney.
But Hamilton, ever ambitious, wrote to Washington stating that he would not serve unless he was made inspector general and second in command. Washington conceded, arguing Hamilton's experience on his staff gave him a better grasp of the overall military scene.
Adams sent Secretary of War James McHenry to Mount Vernon to convince Washington. McHenry conveyed Washington's opinion that he would not serve unless permitted to choose his own officers. Adams, who had intended to appoint Republicans like Aaron Burr to make the army appear bipartisan, found Washington's list consisted entirely of Federalists.
He was cornered.
Adams reluctantly relented and agreed to submit to the Senate the names of Hamilton, Pinckney, and Knox in that order, although final decisions of rank would be reserved to Adams. Knox refused to serve under these conditions. Adams intended to give Hamilton the lowest possible rank, while Washington and many other Federalists insisted that the order submitted must determine seniority. On September 24, Adams received a letter from McHenry relaying a statement from Washington threatening to resign if Hamilton were not made second in command.
Fearing Federalist backlash, Adams capitulated despite bitter resentment, exacerbated by the illness of Abigail, whom Adams feared was near death. It quickly became apparent that due to Washington's advanced age, Hamilton was the army's de facto commander. This was a massive political blow.
It was a significant loss of executive control. However, the Quasi-War continued, but there was a decline in war fever beginning in the fall, once news arrived of the French defeat at the Battle of the Nile. In October, Adams heard from Gerry in Paris that the French wanted to make peace. That December, in his address to Congress, Adams relayed these statements while expressing the need to maintain adequate defenses. The speech angered both Federalists, including Hamilton and Republicans.
Can't please anyone sometimes.
Hamilton, meanwhile, secretly promoted a plan for American and British troops to jointly seize Spanish Florida and Louisiana. Hamilton's critics, including Abigail, saw in his military buildups the signs of an aspiring military dictator.
Hashtag, tag, 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 6.6, Fries's Rebellion and Cabinet Purge, 1798 to 1800.
To pay for the military buildup of the quasi-war, Adams and his Federalist allies enacted the direct tax of 1798. Direct taxation by the federal government was widely unpopular, as revenue under Washington had mostly come from excise taxes and tariffs. Increased military expenditures threatened major budget deficits, so Federalists developed a taxation plan, instituting progressive land value tax.
This was not going to go over well, and it didn't. Taxpayers in eastern Pennsylvania resisted federal tax collectors, and in March 1799, the Bloodless Fries' Rebellion broke out. Led by Revolutionary War veteran John Fries, rural German-speaking farmers protested what they saw as a threat to their liberties. They intimidated tax collectors. The disturbance was quickly ended with Hamilton leading the army to restore peace.
Here's another striking Adams moment. Pardoning the leaders of Fry's rebellion against his entire cabinet's advice, Fry's and two other leaders were arrested, found guilty of treason, and sentenced to hang. They appealed to Adams requesting a pardon. The cabinet unanimously advised Adams to refuse, but he instead granted the pardon, arguing the men had instigated a mere riot as opposed to a full-blown rebellion.
This shows a powerful independent streak and a profound commitment to justice, even when it meant defying his closest advisors and fueling Hamilton's fury. The Fry's Rebellion pardon is a critical example of Adams prioritizing what he perceived as justice and national unity over partisan loyalty. Hamilton, in his infamous pamphlet attacking Adams, wrote that it was impossible to commit a greater error than pardoning Fry's.
So it solidified his image as independent, but deepened the party rift.
Exactly. These frustrations with the Hamilton wing of the party exploded on May 5, 1800, during a meeting with McHenry, a Hamilton loyalist. Adams accused him of subservience to Hamilton and declared that he would rather serve as Jefferson's vice president than be beholden to Hamilton for the presidency. McHenry offered to resign at once, and Adams accepted. On May 10th, he asked Pickering to resign. Pickering refused and was summarily dismissed. Adams named John Marshall as Secretary of State and Samuel Dexter as Secretary of War.
And then he just fires his cabinet. Talk about asserting executive power in a dramatic way.
It was a desperate but necessary attempt to assert control and align his administration with his vision for peace. In 1799, Napoleon took over in France and declared the French Revolution over. News of this event increased Adams's desire to disband the Provisional Army, which, with Washington now dead, was commanded only by Hamilton. His moves to end the army after the departures of McHenry and Pickering were met with little opposition. Federalists joined with the Republicans in voting to disband the army in mid-1800. Hashtag, hashtag, 6.7, peace with France and move to Washington, 1800-1801.
Napoleon, now in power, determining that further conflict was pointless, signaled his readiness for friendly relations with the United States. This led to the Convention of 1800, where the two sides agreed to return any captured ships and allow for the peaceful transfer of non-military goods. On February 3, 1801, the treaty, with some reservations, passed the Senate and was signed by Adams.
This conclusion to his presidency underscores his foresight and commitment to avoiding war, a decision that proved strategically sound for the young republic. While it cost him politically, historians largely commend this choice. News of the peace treaty did not arrive in the United States until after the election, too late to sway the results. As president, Adams proudly avoided war, but deeply split his party in the process.
Historian Ron Chernow writes that the threat of Jacobinism was the one thing that united the Federalist Party, and that Adams's elimination of it unwittingly contributed to the party's demise. He may have lost the election, but Adams secured peace with France, a huge accomplishment that often gets overlooked.
A critical achievement. In terms of establishing institutions, Adams also signed the law establishing the Library of Congress in 1800. His move to Washington, D.C. symbolizes the physical and symbolic establishment of the federal government, a project he had dedicated his life to.
Right, the move to the new capital.
Adams made his first official visit in early June 1800. Amid the raw and unfinished cityscape, the president found the public buildings in a much greater forwardness of completion than expected. He moved into the nearly completed President's Mansion, later known as the White House, on November 1st, with Abigail arriving a few weeks later.
And he wrote that famous prayer.
Yes, on arrival, Adams famously wrote to her, "Before I end my letter, I pray heaven to bestow the best of blessings on this house and all that shall hereafter inhabit it. May none but honest and wise men ever rule under this roof."
It's a poignant moment of transition for him and the nation. The Senate met for the first time in the new Capitol building on November 17, 1800, and on November 22, Adams delivered his fourth State of the Union address to a joint session of Congress. This would actually be the last annual message any president would personally deliver to Congress for the next 113 years. With the Federalist Party deeply split over his negotiations with France and the opposition Republican Party enraged over the Alien and Sedition Acts and the expansion of the military, Adams faced a daunting re-election campaign in 1800. The Federalists nominated Adams and Pinckney. The Republicans, as before, nominated Jefferson and Burr.
The campaign was brutal, characterized by malicious insults from partisan presses on both sides. Federalists claimed that Republicans were the enemies of all who love order, peace, virtue, and religion, denouncing them as libertines and dangerous radicals. Jefferson's rumored affairs with slaves were even used against him.
On the flip side, Republicans accused Federalists of subverting Republican principles, favoring Britain, and promoting aristocratic values. Jefferson was portrayed as an apostle of liberty, while Adams was labeled a monarchist, accused of insanity and even marital infidelity. James T. Callender, a Republican propagandist secretly financed by Jefferson, degraded Adams's character. Callender was arrested and jailed under the Sedition Act, which, of course, further inflamed Republican passions.
This election was a defining moment for American democracy, the first peaceful transfer of power between opposing parties, despite the viciousness. Opposition from the Federalist Party itself was at times equally intense. Some, including Pickering, even accused Adams of colluding with Jefferson. And then there's Hamilton's final attack.
Hamilton was hard at work, attempting to sabotage the president's reelection. He sent a pamphlet strongly attacking Adams' policies and character, denouncing the nomination of Murray, the pardoning of Fries, and the firing of Pickering. He vilified the president's disgusting egotism and ungovernable temper, concluding Adams was emotionally unstable and generally unfit to be president.
It was a scathing personal attack. Strangely, it ended by saying that the electors should support Adams and Pinckney equally, a transparent attempt to elevate Pinckney over Adams. Thanks to Aaron Burr, who had covertly obtained a copy, the pamphlet became public knowledge and was distributed throughout the country by Republicans. Hamilton's actions inadvertently ensured the Federalist Party's eventual demise and effectively ended his own political career.
Talk about self-destruction.
When the electoral votes were counted, Adams finished third and Pinckney came in fourth. Jefferson and Burr tied for first. Because of the tie, the election devolved upon the House of Representatives, where Jefferson was finally elected president after 36 ballots. Historian John Furling attributes Adams' defeat to several key factors: stronger Republican organization, Federalist disunity, the Alien and Sedition Acts, and Jefferson's popularity.
Adams himself seemed to understand it.
Yes. Adams himself offered a candid assessment of his party, writing, "No party that ever existed knew itself so little or so vainly overrated its own influence and popularity as ours." To compound his defeat, Adams' son Charles died shortly after the election. Anxious to rejoin Abigail, Adams departed the White House in the pre-dawn hours of March 4, 1801, and famously did not attend Jefferson's inauguration, a powerful statement of his displeasure. The complications of the 1796 and 1800 elections ultimately prompted a modification to the Electoral College through the 12th Amendment, #7.2 Judicial Appointments and Retirement, 1801 to 1826.
Even in defeat, Adams made a lasting impact by shaping the judiciary for generations. During his term, he appointed two U.S. Supreme Court Associate Justices, Bushrod Washington and Alfred Moore. But his most significant judicial action came at the very end. After Justice Ellsworth's retirement in 1800, it fell to Adams to appoint the court's fourth Chief Justice. Regardless of who won the election, Adams believed the choice should be someone in the full vigor of middle age who could counter a potential long line of Republican presidents.
A strategic move. Adams chose his Secretary of State, John Marshall. Marshall was one of Adams's few trusted cabinet members. Adams signed his commission on January 31st, and the Senate approved it immediately. Marshall's long tenure, from 1801 to 1835, left a lasting influence on the court, maintaining a carefully reasoned nationalistic interpretation of the Constitution and firmly establishing the judicial branch as the equal of the executive and legislative branches. Marshall's appointment was a masterstroke.
That's an incredible act of foresight. Another controversial move in his final days was the Midnight Judges Act. After the Federalists lost control of Congress and the White House, the lame duck session approved a Judiciary Act, creating a set of federal appeals courts. Adams filled the vacancies by appointing a series of judges, whom his opponents called the Midnight Judges, just days before his term expired.
Adams's Midnight Judges appointments, though short-lived, underscore his enduring concern for the balance of power and the strength of the federal government. Most of these judges, however, lost their posts when the next Congress, with a solid Republican majority, approved the Judiciary Act of 1802, abolishing the newly created courts.
So after all that political drama, he heads home.
Yes. Adams resumed farming at Peacefield in Quincy, Massachusetts, and also began work on an autobiography, though it was eventually abandoned. His frugal lifestyle and presidential salary had given him a considerable fortune, but in 1803, the bank holding his cash reserves collapsed. His son, John Quincy, resolved the crisis by buying his properties.
It speaks volumes about the precarious financial situation, even for former presidents then. During his first 4 years of retirement, Adams made little effort to contact others, but eventually resumed contact with old acquaintances like Benjamin Waterhouse and Benjamin Rush. He generally stayed quiet on public matters, not publicly denouncing Jefferson's actions as president, believing that instead of opposing systematically any administration, we ought to support every administration as far as we can in justice.
A very principled stance, especially given their rivalry. When a disgruntled James Callender turned on Jefferson by revealing the Sally Hemings affair, Adams famously said nothing publicly. But he couldn't stay completely quiet, could he? His philosophical and political fire still burned.
Right.
His son, John Quincy, was elected to the Senate in 1803, and both he and his father crossed party lines to support Jefferson's Louisiana Purchase. This demonstrates a capacity for national interest over strict party loyalty. The elder Adams did privately criticize the president over his embargo act, although John Quincy voted for it. John Quincy resigned from the Senate in 1808 after the Federalist-controlled Massachusetts Senate refused to nominate him for a second term. After the Federalists denounced John Quincy, Adams wrote to him that he himself had long since abdicated and disclaimed the name and character and attributes of that sect. #7.3 reconciliation with Jefferson in final years, 1809 to 1826.
The story of Adams and Jefferson's initial estrangement and eventual reconciliation is one of history's great moments. In early 1801, Adams sent Thomas Jefferson a brief note wishing him a happy and prosperous presidency. Jefferson failed to respond, and they did not speak again for nearly 12 years.
A long silence. In 1804, Abigail, unbeknownst to her husband, wrote to Jefferson to express her condolences upon the death of his daughter. This initiated a brief correspondence between the two, which quickly descended into political rancor, and Jefferson terminated it. By 1812, there had been no communication between Monticello and Peacefield since Adams left office.
It was a deep freeze, personally and politically. However, in early 1812, Adams reconciled with Jefferson. The previous year had been tragic for Adams. He lost his brother-in-law, and his daughter Nabby was diagnosed with breast cancer, from which she died in 1813. These events seemed to mellow Adams.
Tragedy often does. Their mutual friend, Benjamin Rush, who had been corresponding with both, actively encouraged them to reach out to each other, a testament to the power of shared history and enduring friendship.
So on New Year's Day, Adams sent a brief, friendly note to Jefferson, accompanying a two-volume collection of lectures on rhetoric by John Quincy Adams. Jefferson replied immediately with a cordial letter, and the two revived their friendship, which they sustained by mail. Their correspondence lasted the rest of their lives and has been hailed as among the great legacies of American literature.
Truly invaluable. Their letters, 158 in total over 14 years, offer a profound window into their mature reflections on republicanism, human nature, and their own roles in history.
Early on, Adams repeatedly tried to turn the correspondence to a discussion of their political actions. Jefferson, however, refused, saying that nothing new can be added by you or me to what has been said by others. Adams made one more attempt, writing that you and I ought not to die before we have explained ourselves to each other. Still, Jefferson declined, and Adams accepted this, with the correspondence turning to other matters, particularly philosophy.
It offers a profound respect that transcended their political differences and personal hurts. For example, the two men famously discussed natural aristocracy. Jefferson believed, "The natural aristocracy I consider as the most precious gift of nature." Adams, ever the pragmatist, wondered if it would ever be so clear who these people were, noting, "Birth and wealth are conferred on some men as imperiously by nature as genius, strength, or beauty." A good government had to account for that reality.
Fascinating how, even in their reconciliation, their core philosophical differences emerged.
Indeed, and it offers a nuanced perspective on leadership. There were also important details that each man kept to himself. Jefferson said nothing about his financial situation or slave ownership, while Adams did not mention the troublesome behavior of his son Thomas. After Jefferson's retirement in 1809, Adams became more vocal, publishing a 3-year marathon of letters in the Boston Patriot newspaper, refuting line by line Hamilton's 1800 pamphlet.
Finally getting his rebuttal out there.
He supported the War of 1812, having worried over the rise of sectionalism, and celebrated the growth of a national character that accompanied it. He even supported James Madison for re-election in 1812. Tragedy struck again with the death of Abigail in October 1818.
A huge loss.
1824 was filled with excitement, featuring a 4-way presidential contest that included John Quincy. The Marquis de Lafayette toured the country and met with Adams, who greatly enjoyed the visit. Adams was delighted by the election of John Quincy to the presidency in February 1825 after a deadlock was decided in the House. His comment on the occasion was classic Adams. No man who ever held the office of president would congratulate a friend on obtaining it.
Always the realist. And then for both of them to die on the exact same day, 50 years to the day after the Declaration of Independence, you couldn't write a more poetic ending.
It's incredible. On July 4th, 1826, Adams died of a heart attack at Peacefield at approximately 6:20 p.m., age 90. His last words included an acknowledgement of his longtime friend and rival. Thomas Jefferson survives. Adams was unaware that Jefferson had died several hours before him. At 90, Adams was the longest-lived U.S. president until Ronald Reagan surpassed him in 2001.
An extraordinary chapter closing in the most symbolic way possible.
Their shared death on such a symbolic day offers a powerful closing statement on the legacy of the revolutionary generation. John and Abigail Adams' crypt at United First Parish Church in Quincy also contains the bodies of John Quincy and Louisa Adams.
Adams was not just a doer, he was a deep thinker. During the First Continental Congress, he was often solicited for his views on government. He privately criticized Thomas Paine's 1776 pamphlet, Common Sense, which attacked all forms of monarchy and supported a unicameral legislature and a weak executive. Adams believed Paine had a better hand at pulling down than building, and that his views were so democratical without any restraint that it must produce confusion.
He saw Paine's ideas as too radical, too unbalanced. This section is crucial for understanding the enduring impact of Adams' intellect. At the urging of delegates like Richard Henry Lee, Adams committed his views to paper, published anonymously in April 1776 as Thoughts on Government. Many historians agree none of Adams' other compositions rivaled its enduring influence.
What were the core ideas?
Adams advised that the form of government should be chosen to attain the desired ends, the happiness and virtue of the greatest number of people. He wrote, "There is no good government but what is republican. The very definition of a republic is an empire of laws and not of men."
His blueprint for a republic was clear and enduring. The treatise defended bicameralism, arguing a single assembly is liable to all the vices, follies, and frailties of an individual. He suggested a separation of powers between the executive, judicial, and legislative branches, and further recommended that a continental government should sacredly be confined to certain enumerated powers. Thoughts on Government was referenced in every state constitution writing hall.
His advocacy for a mixed government and separation of powers was a sophisticated attempt to reconcile republican ideals with human nature. After returning from France in 1779, Adams was elected to the Massachusetts Constitutional Convention. The writing fell primarily to him, and the resulting Constitution of Massachusetts, approved in 1780, was groundbreaking. It was the first written by a special committee and ratified by the people. It was also the first to feature a bicameral legislature, a distinct executive with a qualified veto, and an independent judicial branch with lifetime appointments.
His contributions, particularly through the Massachusetts Constitution, directly influenced the U.S. Constitution. This Constitution also affirmed the duty to worship the Supreme Being and the right to do so freely. It also established free public education. Adams was a strong believer in education as a pillar of the Enlightenment.
This holistic approach is deeply insightful. Adams articulated his preoccupation with politics, which separated him from his family, in 1780. "I must study politics and war that my sons may have the liberty to study mathematics and philosophy in order to give their children a right to study painting, poetry, music, architecture." He envisioned a future where arts and sciences could flourish due to political stability.
What a beautiful vision. While in London, he learned of the convention plan to amend the Articles of Confederation. In January 1787, he published his 3-volume, A Defense of the Constitutions. The pamphlet repudiated European critics of American state governments. He suggested that the rich, the well-born, and the able should be set apart in a Senate to prevent them from dominating the lower house. Adams contended that social classes exist in every political society and that a good government must accept that reality. A mixed regime balancing monarchy, aristocracy, and democracy was required to preserve order and liberty.
His consistent vision shines through. On separation of powers, Adams wrote that power must be opposed to power and interest to interest. This sentiment was later echoed by James Madison in Federalist No. 51. Adams believed humans naturally wanted to further their own ambitions, and a single democratic house needed checks from an upper house and an executive. He wrote that a strong executive would defend the people's liberties against aristocrats.
His detailed arguments demonstrate his profound distrust of concentrated power. Adams first saw the new United States Constitution in late 1787 and wrote to Jefferson that he read it with great satisfaction. However, he did express regret that the president couldn't make appointments without Senate approval and over the absence of a Bill of Rights, highlighting his enduring concern for both effective executive authority and individual protections. Hashtag 8.2 views on slavery. It's important to highlight that Adams stood firm against slavery personally, even when it was common and financially beneficial. He never owned a slave and declined on principle to use slave labor, saying, "I have, through my whole life, held the practice of slavery in such abhorrence that I've never owned a Negro or any other slave, even when it cost him thousands of dollars for the labor of free men."
Adams's personal record on slavery is commendable, setting him apart from many other founders. Before the war, he even occasionally represented slaves in suits for their freedom, a truly principled stance. However, Adams generally tried to keep the issue out of national politics because of the anticipated Southern response during a time when unity was needed.
Political pragmatism again?
Right. He spoke out in 1777 against a bill to emancipate slaves in Massachusetts, saying that the issue was presently too divisive, so the legislation should sleep for a time. He was also against the use of black soldiers in the Revolution due to opposition from Southerners.
His political pragmatism, while understandable in context, reveals the deep-seated challenges of confronting slavery. But in Massachusetts, his influence was clear. Slavery was abolished there around 1780, forbidden by implication in the Declaration of Rights that John Adams wrote into the Massachusetts Constitution. And it's worth noting that Abigail Adams vocally opposed slavery as well.
His actions and statements, including the implicit abolition through the Massachusetts Constitution, demonstrate a clear moral opposition, making his personal and constitutional contributions significant within his own state. #8.3 Monarchism and Religious Views.
Adams was a man of complex and often seemingly contradictory views, particularly regarding monarchical institutions. At times, he conveyed substantial support, suggesting, for example, that hereditary monarchy or aristocracy are the only institutions that can possibly preserve the laws and liberties of the people. Yet, at other times, he vehemently distanced himself, calling himself a mortal and irreconcilable enemy to monarchy.
Adams's monarchical statements were often misinterpreted as a desire for a king, when in fact they stem from a profound concern about the potential for democratic excesses and the need for strong executive and aristocratic checks against an oligarchy of the wealthy. His 1790 Discourses on Davila warned once again of the dangers of unbridled democracy, further fueling accusations of monarchism.
People suggested he planned to crown himself king and grooming John Quincy as heir.
Exactly. Adams felt that the great danger was that an oligarchy of the wealthy would take hold. To counter that danger, the power of the wealthy needed to be channeled by institutions and checked by a strong executive.
So his perceived monarchism was more about a fear of unchecked power. And his religious beliefs were equally complex. According to biographer David McCullough, quote, "Adams was both a devout Christian and an independent thinker, and he saw no conflict in that."
His religious views, a fascinating blend of inherited Puritanism and Enlightenment rationalism, demonstrate a profound personal faith that informed his public virtue. Adams was raised Congregationalist. In Quincy, the Unitarian faction was dominant and included Adams and his father. It denied the Trinity and the divinity of Jesus Christ. In 1825, the Unitarians split off as a separate denomination that included John Adams. His family descended from Puritans, and Adams praised them as bearers of freedom.
A strong moral compass. Historians suggest Adams's beliefs synthesized Puritan, deist, and humanist concepts. While he shared perspectives with deists, he clearly wasn't one, believing in miracles, providence, and the Bible as revelation. In 1796, Adams famously denounced Thomas Paine's deistic criticisms of Christianity, saying, "The Christian religion is the religion of wisdom, virtue, equity, and humanity. Let the blackguard Paine say what he will."
This nuanced understanding helps us appreciate his unique contribution. Gordon S. Wood writes, "Although both Jefferson and Adams denied the miracles and the divinity of Christ, Adams always retained a respect for the religiosity of people that Jefferson never had.
In retirement, Adams moved closer to mainstream Enlightenment religious ideals. He blamed institutional Christianity for causing suffering, but insisted that religion was necessary for society. Hashtag 8.4 historical reputation and legacy.
Benjamin Franklin, with his usual wit, summarized what many thought of Adams, saying, "He means well for his country. Is always an honest man, often a wise one, but sometimes, and in some things, absolutely out of his senses." Adams himself strongly felt that he would be forgotten and underappreciated by history, feelings that often manifested themselves through envy and verbal attacks on other founders. It's both tragic and ironic that a man who so feared being forgotten largely faded from public memory for so long.
Adams's legacy is complex, marked by both profound foresight and significant missteps. Historian Edmund Morgan argues, "Adams was ridiculously vain, absurdly jealous, but no man ever served his country more selflessly." Historian George C. Herring argued that Adams was the most independent-minded of the founders. Though aligned with the Federalists, he was somewhat a party unto himself, disagreeing with them as much as he did the Republicans.
His personal character, though challenging, often proved to be a driving force for the nation's good. Adams was often described as prickly, but his tenacity was fed by decisions made in the face of universal opposition. He was often combative, as he admitted. "As president, I refused to suffer in silence. I sighed, sobbed, and groaned, and sometimes screeched and screamed, and I sometimes swore." Quite the admission. Stubbornness was seen as one of his defining traits, a fact for which Adams made no apology. "Thanks to God that he gave me stubbornness when I know I am right." This self-awareness underpinned his actions. His resolve to advance peace with France reduced his popularity and contributed to his defeat. Most historians, however, applaud him for avoiding an all-out war. His signing of the Alien and Sedition Acts is almost always condemned. His leadership on naval defense earned him the title Father of the American Navy. But in the 21st century, Adams remains less well-known than many founders, just as he predicted. McCullough argued that the problem with Adams is that most Americans know nothing about him. Todd Leopold of CNN wrote he's remembered as that guy who served a single term. Furling says he's seen as honest and dedicated, but still overshadowed.
While his concern about being overlooked proved true for a time, a deeper examination reveals an intellectual and political titan. In 2001, McCullough published the biography John Adams, which sold very well. Along with the Furling biography, it contributed to a rapid resurgence in Adams's reputation. In 2008, the miniseries based on McCullough's book further cemented his place in popular culture.
Adams is commemorated as the namesake of various counties' buildings, like the John Adams Building of the Library of Congress. He is honored on the memorial to the 56 signers, but doesn't have an individual monument in D.C. McCullough states this is absolutely inexcusable.
He was in many ways the conscience of the Revolution, prioritizing principled governance over personal popularity. The recent resurgence of interest finally allows us to see the full, complex individual, appreciating his profound impact, flaws and all, as a central architect of American democracy. Hashtag tag outro.
So what does this all mean for us today? Our deep dive into John Adams has revealed a man of unwavering principle, a tenacious lawyer, a shrewd diplomat, and an independent president who prioritized peace and stability for the fledgling nation, often at great personal and political cost.
His life was marked by fierce intellect, a passionate belief in the rule of law, and profound personal sacrifices, all in service of the American experiment.
His story reminds us that the founding of America wasn't just a smooth narrative of universally adored heroes. It was messy, full of rivalries, deeply difficult choices, and monumental struggles undertaken by imperfect but ultimately dedicated people.
Understanding Adams helps us appreciate the full spectrum of challenges and ideals that forged this nation, and how individual character can profoundly shape historical outcomes. You've heard a lot of detail about this remarkable man today, hopefully gaining a fresh perspective on a figure often relegated to the background.
Adams, fearing he'd be forgotten, once wrote, "The history of our revolution will be one continued lie. The essence of the whole will be that Dr. Franklin's electrical rod smote the earth and outsprung General Washington." Considering his life, his immense contributions, and his ultimate fate of being overshadowed, it raises an important question for us today. Whose stories are we still overlooking in our simplified narratives of history, and what crucial, complex insights might we gain by bringing them back into the light?
That's a great question. We encourage you to delve deeper into the life of John Adams, perhaps exploring his own extensive writings, or the fascinating correspondence between him and Abigail, or even revisiting the stories of other lesser-known founders. There's always more to learn and uncover when you scratch beneath the surface of history.